Tom Woods had me on a show to talk about my book, Against the State, An Anarcho-Capitalist Manifesto. This is just the first installment of a couple of appearances, which I thank Tom very much for, and hope you'll find it interesting.
What a thrill and a privilege it is to be joined today by Lou Rockwell. Of course, you know Lou from lourockwell.com, the indispensable website, but he's also the founder and chairman of the Mises Institute, the heroic Mises Institute, former chief of staff to Ron Paul, an all-around great guy. Like me, Lou is originally from Massachusetts, and that's where I'm heading today for a week's vacation. If you can believe, I'm actually going on vacation. And my wife and I are taking all five children. We have five girls ranging from just about 11 all the way down to newborn. So ask me next week whether that turned out to be a good idea or not. Actually, you know, we took a vacation to Manhattan in New York City last summer. We had four kids at that time. We took three of them with us, and we had a wonderful time. It was just one exciting thing after another. We had a great time, so I'm confident this will be the same way. But don't worry, in my absence, there will be episodes of the Tom Woods Show. That's just how I am. I want to be known for reliability, that every weekday you can get your episode of the Tom Woods Show. If you're subscribing on iTunes or Stitcher, you are really making me happy. You can do that over at TomWoodsRadio.com. Well, right now, let's turn to Lou Rockwell. Lou, welcome back to the show.
Tom, great to be with you.
I'm always looking for an excuse to have you on, and a new book is about the best reason in the world. And moreover, a new book called Against the State, An Anarcho-Capitalist Manifesto, is the best reason I can possibly imagine to have somebody on. So,
you're very nice to say that.
Well, let's start off with what your definition is, how you would explain to the man on the street what this scary-sounding term anarcho-capitalism is all about.
Well, first of all, this is Murray Rothbard's term. And, in fact, this entire book is, in a sense, a tribute to Murray, as well as derived from Murray. So he's the inventor of anarcho-capitalism. There were anarchists before Murray, obviously capitalists before Murray, but it was his combination of the two things along with Austrian economics that made libertarianism and anarcho-capitalism what they are. So, in fact, he once said that anarchism was fulfilled in capitalism, capitalism fulfilled in anarchism. So what is it? It's the view that, and there's a wonderful essay, by the way, by Stefan Kinsella on lourockwell.com about what's an anarchist. And this is, of course, again, derived from Rothbard. Is it ever, if we think of libertarianism and certainly anarcho-capitalism, it's really, when can you initiate force against somebody? When can the state, which of course is the sort of organization of violence in society, when is it justified to initiate aggression against someone? The anarcho-capitalist says never. It is never justified to initiate aggression, initiate violence and force, if somebody is innocent. Now, of course, you can respond with violence. If somebody's invading your home and breaking down the door, can you then respond with violence? Yes. I mean, there are people who believe not. I'm not one of those. Although I appreciate the pacifist view, I'm not a pacifist. But if you, to the conservative, to the liberal, to the communist, to the socialist, to the fascist, for that matter, even classical liberals, the state can initiate force against the innocent, whether it's to collect taxes, to make them, pay their parking fine, and draft them to go to war, all the various things that the government does to us. So the anarcho-capitalist says no, never, is never, never morally justified to initiate force, violence, or the threat of violence against the innocent. So if you were to describe that to the man on the street, a lot of times they say, oh, well, of course that's right.
Right, yeah, we all favor that.
You should never do that. But, of course, they don't actually, once you start to get into examples, well, is the government ever able to just decide it's going to take X percentage of your of the money you earn this year and spend it on itself. Of course, they think, well, of course, that's actually necessary because we have to have roads, we have to have mass murder in Afghanistan or, you know, and everything else in between. We have to have a state. So the anarcho-capitalist says, no, we don't need a state. We don't need this ruler over us in society, run, of course, not by, despite the American propaganda, not by the people. It's always a parasitic elite. And they live off the rest of us. They do it through propaganda. For the most part, they couldn't, and this is Etienne de Labouedi's and other people's view, they can't actually just use force against. The rulers can't just use force all the time against the ruled. There are too many of the ruled. They are a small minority, after all, and they have to be a small minority in order to live it up in the style to which they've become accustomed and reward their friends and do all the things they want. It can't be too large a group. So it's not the people. It's this little tiny group of elites that were taught from the earliest days in the government schools. Thank goodness we've got these people because they're concerned about the public good, the common good, the national defense, and all the rest of these slogans that, upon examination, actually don't mean what they claim them to mean. But rather mean what the power elite, the people who are actually running the state for their own benefit and the benefit of their cronies, it's just the whole thing is a fraud. So I think of this book, and it's not a scholarly book. I mean, it's not. There's many Rothbard, Hoppe, many great. People have written scholarly works on anarcho-capitalism and related issues. This is like this is like the people's book. Maybe this is a man on the streets book. But I'd like to try to convince people who are already inclined towards liberty that they need to go all the way, that they need to not give an inch to the state, not say ever go along with their looting, what they call it taxation, their mass murder, they call it war, their kidnapping, whether it's the public schools or military conscription. So all that sort of conduct is unjust, it's immoral, and we should all be opposed to it. Is this just, you know, an entirely utopian view? Is it, well, it's ridiculous, it could never happen? And I think it maybe can and has happened in the past in some societies. Thomas Jefferson famously wrote that he really admired the American Indians because they were all anarchists, and they didn't have government. But he said, unfortunately, that's only suitable for uncivilized people. For civilized people like himself, they needed the government, and of course he ran the government for a time. So I think that it's not utopian, but in another sense, maybe if one is dedicated to ending, let's say, murder. If somebody is concerned about all the murders that take place in this country, we'll just mention private murders, not the government murders, and wants to dedicate his life to trying to do everything possible to lessen the number of murders, he might feel he's never going to entirely succeed. There always are going to be murders, but is it possible to diminish the number of murders? Yeah, I think so. So is it actually to diminish, is it possible to diminish the state and this all this unbelievable amount of violence and how many, you know, what size are the Himalayas of corpses that just to take our own wonderful government, the U.S. government, has built up over the centuries? Is it possible to diminish that? Yes, I think so. And it's through people learning what the story is and really taking the Rothbardian red pill, and the scales fall from your eyes, and you never see government politicians, the government's media, the government's academia, government's big business, all these various forces in society constantly promoting the state. You don't ever see them the same, and if enough people come to actually not believe in them, then they're much diminished. So I think there is real hope. I especially see it among young people who are not buying into the system. This is thanks to Ron Paul in large part, of course. we're not buying into the system like older people do, who don't ever think there's going to be, you know, Social Security for them, who are worried about the debts they've got, who are worried whether they're going to have a job, or they're going to have to live with their parents into middle age or longer, and all the horrible things that so many young people face and worry about for their futures. They're much more open to questioning everything that the official line lays down for us. So I hope this book will, it's a short book, I mean, it's less than 200 pages. I hope that it will encourage people not only to be interested in these ideas, to read the important stuff, basically Rothbard, but others too, and to withdraw their consent. It's not necessary to bow down to these people. It's not necessarily to think that just because somebody's in a government union that they're a superior person over the taxpayers and really deserve to, as the typical federal employee or state or local government employee makes more than twice as much as the typical person paying the taxes. So you start to question these things. You can get other people interested. It could be a very long process. It could take centuries. Although sometimes ideas, the climate of opinion, can change seemingly almost overnight. So I think it's so important from a moral standpoint, from a strategic standpoint, that we question the government, question what they do, question their morality, tell the truth about their lies, because every word out of the government's mouth is a lie, and then, or certainly should be assumed to be a lie unless proven otherwise. So because of course they don't ever want to tell the truth. They can't actually say, we're not spending all this money to help the poor, we're spending it on ourselves and on our friends and empowering ourselves and making us bigger and more important people and richer people and so forth. So important to tell the truth, to learn the truth, to study some political philosophy, just like it's important to learn some economics, to learn some history, real history, and real economics. And so I think I'm very optimistic about the long-term future, just because of young people in this country and all around the world are questioning all this stuff. And so the government, I think, has got less and less prestige. Just to take, Pat Buchanan had an interesting column today talking about the VA. And he said, here's, the single-payer medical system that people are always telling us we should be having. And, of course, it's a horrendous disaster. Also, like the other government single-payer systems, the Indian Health Service or the Public Health Service hospitals, it's a total disaster. And who's surprised? I mean, who really is surprised that this is the government? And anybody who's been around the military knows it's the same in the military. It's the same in the post office. It's the same in PUD or the Department of Education. The same in every single public school. So these things are losing popularity. People are losing trust in them. This is the moment for people who believe in freedom.
Lou, I had a guy named Larkin Rose on this program not too long ago, and he said that the thing that made him think differently was that he realized that when it came down to it, he was making the same kind of argument that his left liberal opponents were making, that they would say that, of course, we have to take your money to make you better off. And he would say, no, 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 no. But we do need to take some of your money to make you better off, yes. And then he thought, well, wait a minute. Hold on a minute. Maybe that whole principle needs to be rejected. Now, and I know that there will be listeners who will say, all right, Woods and Rockwell, I see where you're coming from, and it's wonderful to have these moral principles, but facts are facts, and at some point you have to live in a civilized society, and we all know we need the government for that. And I guess I would just say, is that an attractive position to hold? Whether or not that's correct, is that a position that you're really happy with? That it's great having these moral principles, but come on. Like, is that really where you want to rest your intellectual, where you want to stop with your conclusions? Or at least I think you owe it to yourself to think this through, not just to think it through superficially for 10 seconds, but to read people like Rothbard and to read people who have taken the football since his time and pushed it ahead and thought about these ideas. If it could possibly work, then you have to consider it. You have to. I mean, the default position, my old friend Donald Livingston says, the default position, the starting position in your thinking about government should be anarchism. That should be the default position, that individuals just interact with each other. And only when you feel like you are totally stumped do you bring in the state. Now, I wouldn't make that concession, but I like his initial starting point. Now, let me shift gears, though, because I want to get to some specifics in the book. You've got a number of chapters in here, but three of them are dealing with the following topics. We've got the Federal Reserve, we've got the war on drugs, and we have war in general. Now, those are three issues, and look, there are plenty of Republican politicians I've endorsed over the years, but those are three issues that you can pretty much count on a Republican politician being absolutely terrible on, and yet, aren't those three pretty important? Why are those three so important?
Well, they are extremely important, and of course there was Ron Paul, right? I mean,
right. But the thing is, I hated to soil him by saying Republican politician and Ron Paul in the same sentence.
Well, you know, it's just to mention Ron, he actually is a wonderful politician in the pure sense, in the sense of convincing people of his views, in the sense of building coalitions, and even just when he would run for office, when he ran for Congress, he would typically wear out 5 or 6 pairs of shoes during the campaigning season because he walked so many neighborhoods. So, and of course, the internet and his national political campaigns always run on a purely educational basis, not for power. And he always said he didn't want power. He didn't want to run other people's lives. He's entirely sound on these three issues. So why are they important? Well, first of all, the Federal Reserve, and we can take that as a symbol for all government control of money. I mean, from the various early days, I think we can demonstrate that money did not start with government, but that when money developed in the market as the most liquid good and replacing barter and so forth, that the governments mainly saw what was the possibilities and grabbed it, nationalized it, stamped the king's face on it, and proceeded to debase it. So in the old days, they were actually limited to the amount of debasement that they did. The Roman denarius in the early days was a silver coin. Eventually, became a silver plated copper coin. So there's a limit to what they could do. The very unfortunate development in the 17th century with the Bank of England of the central bank just took this to another level. And specifically, by the way, to wage war was why the Bank of England was set up. And the king thought it was just wonderful to have someplace that was going to fund his wars without the necessity of going through Parliament. So today, and then the worst central bank ever, of course, was the Federal Reserve established in 1913 after a long propaganda campaign. And what it does is it enables all the banks to inflate together, expand the money supply, and not go out of business, because banks always want to inflate. They always want to issue more paper notes than they, or IOUs than they have specie in their vaults and so forth in the old days. But the bank run prevented that from getting out of hand. You know, Murray always loved the old Western movies where, you know, there'd be a hue and cry. Hey, the money's not in the bank, and everybody loan up, and the bank went out of business. So he always thought if we actually had the right sort of monetary and banking system, you'd want a bank run league, so, you know, start rumors about, hey, there's no money in the bank, and if a bank was sound, they could give people their money. If it wasn't sound, they couldn't. It, by the way, is illegal in most states to spread rumors about banks being insolvent. Somehow, the freedom of speech doesn't apply to that. Mm. So we've had an unbelievable amount of monetary depreciation since the establishment of the Fed. I sometimes wonder, you know, this was just before World War I, of course, was the Fed established to fund the wars, or did they run the wars to make use of the Fed? I don't know, but it all went together. And without central banking, for example, there could not have been, I don't believe, world wars. Well, you know, there have always been wars as long as there have been governments, the sort of world war, the massive, the unbelievably massive destruction and murder politically, economically, morally horrendous World War I and World War II, these sorts of wars could only take place with central banking, because there's no way that people would ever agree to pay the taxes. And there is, people can resist paying taxes. They call it war weariness when people, or they used to, when, I remember you giving a wonderful talk about this at a Mises Circle in New York. So there is, people got sick and tired of it. And by the way, that still exists today, despite the Fed. We see why Obama's having trouble invading Syria and going to war against Russia and sending troops to the Ukraine and maybe all the things that some of the politicians would love to be doing. They can't get away with it. But on the other hand, they were able to, George W. Bush was able to run his war in Iraq, his war on Afghanistan, without any concerns about whether people would be willing to pay the taxes. They just printed it up. And this is the mentality of course, everybody in the House of Representatives and the Senate. They don't have to worry about getting people to agree to go along with this stuff. They just print it up. So it's had the effects of bringing on business cycles. Business cycles are not, just don't fall like the rain from heaven. These are creations of the central bank, if not deliberate creations, but inevitable creations of their monetary policies.
Lou, let me interject for a second. I can't help mentioning, somebody told me on my Facebook page that the other day Garry Kasparov, the chess champion, was, I guess, on a Cato Institute podcast or something like that, and he was saying that liberty at home and liberty abroad are inseparable, that I can't just lean back and enjoy my liberty somewhere when somebody else's liberties are being threatened. And so this is why, even though war may be an unpleasant thing, it may be a moral imperative. What's your reaction to that?
Well, first of all, I'd say, hey, Gary, let's drop you over Kiev with a, you know, with a rifle and a parachute.
I know it.
Right? These chicken hawks, of course, always want to do that sort of thing. And I must say, when people are refugees here from another government, and that's, you know, it's great to have Kasparov here, but I don't like it when they bring their own, their ethnic, ancient ethnic hatreds here. We got enough problems without people campaigning that we need to, you know, quote-unquote, free Ukraine or Crimea, whatever, which means bringing them under the aegis of the U.S. That's the U.S. government, probably the only government in history with both the ambition, maybe they all have the ambition, but certainly the ability probably to become a world government. It tends to become the world government. And so everything is its business. And, of course, it's not liberty. It's U.S. control
right.
that is being sought. So I think Kasparov's full of baloney, and all I can say is, if you don't like the Russians, well, you know, raise money, propagandize, get a gun and go over there, whatever. Don't involve the rest of us. Don't try to involve the rest of us. So I think it's nonsensical, and I think it was, you know, some of the framers made this point that really you can't have an empire overseas and a limited republic. Obviously, I think there's problems with that whole conception, but you can't have any restraints on government here at home if it's just enabled to kill people, to do whatever it wants in other countries.
Exactly. Yeah, I think you've hit on something. This gives me the idea that the real truth is not that liberty at home depends on liberty abroad. It's that intervention abroad brings back intervention at home, that all the imperial stuff that the U.S. has been up to has led directly to the TSA and all these other things that we can't stand and spying on us. It's all part of the big imperial mission. You can't separate the two. So it's not that liberty is inseparable at home and abroad. It's that tyranny is inseparable at home and abroad. That's the real truth of the matter. And by the way, on my Facebook page the other day, so I once in a while I jump in, and I shouldn't, right? I'm busy, but I can't help myself. And I was saying this is a perfect example of the utter hopelessness of the conservative movement, which I, by the way, came out of. So you can be a refugee from it and go
Me
on
too.
To prosper, you know, right? Okay? You know, there is life after this thing. But the key point that I was making is that I would have thought that a conservative who really wants to preserve the, you know, what Russell Kirk called the permanent things and all that would be skeptical of foreign intervention, because he would say that the idea that I can't just quietly enjoy my liberty as long as somebody else's liberty in the world is being threatened means I will never be able to enjoy my liberty ever, because there will always be wrongdoing somewhere in the world. We'll be in a condition of permanent war, permanent revolution, permanent intervention, permanent bureaucracy, permanent government growth, forever, forever, and ever, and ever. That is the least, at least if we're going to take them at their word that they're conservatives, they want to conserve something, that's the least conservative approach to anything I have ever heard.
And I think it's true, and of course it also fulfills their real goal, which is to make war against their own people. The U.S. government makes war against the American people, and running wars overseas strengthens that. So, you know, whether they want to spy on us, of course they want to spy on the world, they want to spy on the foreign businesses for the benefit of U.S. government-connected big business and so forth. So they do want to spy on everybody. They mainly want to spy on us. I mean, it's us that whose emails they want to read. They want to, not because they think we're terrorists, because they want to control us and they're worried about dissent. I think Glenn Greenwald later today is going to release a list of everybody the NSA was spying on here at home. And he's going to talk, of course, about the important people because they spy on everybody. But there are priorities. And why do I think it's going to be people that were the politicians, and to make sure there's no dissent? It didn't work with Ron Paul, but it certainly works with the rest of them. So what the government does to us here at home is absolutely strengthened and enabled by the boogeyman over the hill that they have to go kill and tax us and run us, suppress dissent, all the horrible things that follow with war. It enables the government to do the horrible things to us they really want to do. I guess every government would be a totalitarian system if they could get away with it. And certainly the U.S., especially since 9/11, which I suppose they secretly celebrate as a great day, because it certainly has been great for the government and for the military apparatus and the military-industrial complex and the spy apparatus and all. So they're going, you know, it's been increasing very fast, and right initially I thought, well, you know, I'm sort of never understood emotionally how the Nazis came to power. Now I understand it when I saw Americans' reactions to and their happiness with the Patriot Act and other enabling acts of the Bush administration. I might just tell this one quick story about Russell Kirk.
Please do.
Russell wrote some wonderful stuff against the draft. Before he was associated with Bill Buckley, he wrote some terrible stuff about the Cold War when he was associated with Bill Buckley. But afterwards, he sort of returned to his initial anti-war roots. But in his last letter to me, he had a handwritten P.S. where he said he hoped that George H.W. Bush was hanged on the White House lawn for the war in Iraq.
You know, Lou, I had Brad Berzer on. He's actually writing an intellectual biography of Kirk to come out later this year. He's a professor at Hillsdale. And he laughed out loud and loved that. And he said, he didn't doubt that at all. That sounded just like his sense of humor. I love that story, by the way, because, of course, it makes the typical movement conservative, you know, it makes his head explode. What? I thought that's something a liberal would say. Like, they all live in this Ann Coulter world that I, to my shame, I once inhabited. And eventually you realize this is a place unfit for a third grader. Get me out of here. Where is the exit? Well, Lou, I know for a fact that people listening to this conversation would like it to keep on going. But as I always say, I always want to leave people wanting more. So we'll have you on again in the very near future. I'd like to have you on, actually, the day the book becomes available. This was to get people tantalized and on the verge of wanting it. Do you have a rough estimate as to the release date of Against the State?
Well, it's going to be on Amazon Kindle as an e-book, and it's going to be on CreateSpace, which is the Amazon publishing, physical book publishing arm. As a paperback, it's going to be inexpensive. It's going to be $3.95 as an ebook, $9.95 as a paperback. And by the way, these print-on-demand systems are producing spectacularly good-looking books. That wasn't true, say, 10 years ago, but today they're putting the old-line publishers out of business, which I'm not exactly shedding any tears over. So. I think the ebook is going to be out this week, probably another week beyond that for the physical book. But as soon as I get exact times, I'll let you know. And sure, of course, I would be honored to come back on.
Oh yeah, we definitely want to have you come back on. So now people, now they know, because remember the rule of advertising is that people need to hear something about seven times before they pull the trigger on it. So this is time number one, at least for some of my listeners. Lou, thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Tom. Bye bye.
All right, everybody, make sure and watch for Against the State, an anarcho-capitalist manifesto. I'm seeing in my inbox right now a note saying that it will be available on June 3rd. So keep an eye out for that. We'll have Lou back on a couple weeks after it comes out. We'll talk some more about it. It sounds very exciting, and it's such a pleasure to have Lou with us. Remember, I'll be speaking in Boston on June 2nd, St. Paul, Minnesota, June 19th, and Nashville, Tennessee, August 15th. Check my personal site for information on those events, tomwoods.com. There's an events page there, tomwoods.com/events. If you like this show, if you're benefiting from it as you hear it every day, make sure and become a supporting listener of the show. Supporting listeners for as little as 5 smackers a month get transcripts of every interview we do. These things are like gold. And to help me pay for them, you become a supporting listener, and then you get to read them, and they're great. Plus 60% off at mylibertyclassroom.com and a bunch of other discounts. We've got a discount at the Mises store for supporting listeners of this program, for example. So it's just like AAA. It pays for itself if you use it right. So warm my heart by heading over to supportinglisteners.com. I sure appreciate that.
Well, thanks so much for listening to the Lou Rockwell Show today. Take a look at all the podcasts. There have been hundreds of them. There's a link on the LRC front page. Thank you.